Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we continue exploring Hollywood's influence on the politics in the U.S. with historian Stephen Ross. Then, April is a notorious month for genocide and mass human rights abuses. We'll analyze the forces of genocide and the means of preventing future genocides. Last week, we began a two-part discussion with Stephen Ross, historian at University of Southern California, about his book, Hollywood Left and Right, which is just out in paperback. We talked about the early political efforts of Hollywood movie stars, including those of Charlie Chaplin and Louis Mayer. Their efforts influenced the politics of the United States, but also had an influence on how other performers participated in politics. This is part two of that discussion. Welcome, Stephen Ross. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Today, we've got Warren Beatty, we've got Charlton Heston, the legacy of Ronald Reagan and Arnold Schwarzenegger. Do you see a development of how their politics have come, or do you see them more individually compartmentalized?
It's interesting. I would say stars on the left have been more individually compartmentalized. And ironically, the stars on the right have followed a trajectory of how to use media. And again, not just followed a trajectory, created a trajectory of how to use media to further their political goals. So I mentioned Louis B. Mayer is the first one who starts with radio and figures out radio. And also Mayer, by 28 and 32, is staging the Republican conventions, and he's turning them into entertainment venues. He says, you know, a convention is no different than a movie opening. So you got to stage, it has to be a big hullabaloo, it has to be a big gathering. People need to want to see it rather than ought to see it. Murphy pioneers the use of television. I mean, he's talking about camera angles, about makeup. To me, what was interesting, in 1948, he's telling Tom Dewey, audiences don't like you. They may vote for you. They don't like you because you're a smarty pants. You always have a quick answer. And he tells them, next time you go on TV, flub a line. And in fact, go on with a mustard stain on your tie. Look human. And Dewey blows him off and then loses the election. And 2 years later, when he runs again for governor, uses everything
that he
was told.
Did he put a mustard stain?
That I'm not sure, but he changed his appearance. Arnold Schwarzenegger is the next big breakthrough. He's truly the first one not just to understand the nature of 24/7 media, but use it. Schwarzenegger, if you look at people like Murphy, who goes on to become senator, for some of your listeners may not go back that far, remember, but Murphy was senator of California, elected in 1964. Reagan is elected as governor in 1966, and as we know, president in 1980. But what we don't know, when Schwarzenegger ran in the recall, the newspapers got it wrong, because they kept talking about how he was similar to Murphy and Reagan, two B-movie stars who simply went into the political arena without knowing much. They just, you know, used their celebrity. They were totally wrong. Murphy and Reagan had worked in the trenches, worked as part of the building the conservative movement. Murphy from the 30s on, and Reagan really gets involved in the 50s. With conservative politics, he's shifting from a liberal Democrat to liberal anti-communist Democrat, and finally a conservative Republican by the early 50s. But when they enter the political arena, they've had 2 decades of working with Republican groups around the country, but particularly in California. What's interesting about Schwarzenegger is the first Hollywood figure to run for office with no real political ties. The only thing he had done is really campaign for George H.W. Bush.
But he married a political family.
That's right. He married into the Kennedys. And it's something, you know, I found some of his early writings and interviews. And when he was 18, he said, here's what my life is going to be. I'm going to be famous. I'm going to be a celebrity. And then I'm going to be a famous movie star. And then I'm going to be really wealthy. And then I'm going to marry into a famous political family and go for office. And everything he has said as a young man, he did in his life.
He probably didn't predict the latter part, though, with the affairs and the...
Well, he didn't say that, but that's beyond that trajectory. But he did everything he said. And when he ran, what audiences probably don't realize is he got the recall was the greatest thing that could have happened to him. Because if he had to go through a Republican primary, I don't believe he would have gotten the nomination. Because Arnold is very much like the liberal Republicans of the late 1960s, very conservative on fiscal and defense issues and liberal on personal social issues. But in a contest of 150 some odd people running in the recall, he has the big name and he's able to win. And the other thing he does is he runs on his celebrity and not on the issues. He decides early on that, in fact, he said later on, Ted Kennedy, his uncle, gave him the advice, delay talking about specifics, because once you talk about specifics, they're going to tear you apart. So when it's less than a week to go from the election, and the LA Times runs a full page where they have, I think, roughly about a dozen of the leading candidates, and they've got these little boxes of like six major issues, and in a phrase, what the candidate says about the issues, Arnold's columns were completely blank. And it was only a week to go that he started talking about some of the issues. He was running on his celebrity. He was running on his fame. He was running on lines like, I'm going to tell legislators who aren't doing their job that they are going to be hasta la vista, baby, and talking about them as being girly men, and really playing and doing a lot of stunts.
He got 45% of the vote, as yes. I remember. Would that have worked in a regular election needed more than a majority?
It would have worked in a regular election if he could have gotten through the Republican primaries, but I don't believe he would have beaten Tom McClintock that time in the Republican primaries because the Republican Party was too conservative. They would not have gone for Arnold.
But again, the fact that he got 45% of the vote, or some thereabouts, I may have the number slightly off, suggests that maybe he couldn't have gotten a majority, at least the first time out, on those particular celebrities.
Well, I think you're wrong. When he's running against somebody as lackluster as Cruz Bustamante or even Tom McClintock, those were his two big opponents. Remember, we had two votes. One, are we going to recall Gray right. Davis? And if Davis is recalled, who do you vote for governor? And you had Cruz Bustamante, Tom McClintock, the outside Arianna Huffington, and Arnold.
Arnold Schwarzenegger, you point out, tended to always have a particular political ideology that was conservative fiscally. His predecessors, yes. like Ronald Reagan, they sort of moved from ideology to ideology, didn't they? Especially Reagan.
Well, they didn't move from ideology to ideology. They moved from left to right. That's the other interesting thing I saw is George Murphy started as a New Deal Democrat and quickly became a Republican. Reagan started as a New Deal Democrat, and in his autobiography writes, even at the end of World War II, he called himself a bleeding heart liberal and eventually moves to become a conservative Republican. Charlton Heston was the first Hollywood figure to march in a civil rights parade demonstration. He was a liberal Democrat who endorsed the New Deal and was, in fact, a liberal Democrat up until 1972, and then he became a conservative. Arnold never was a liberal. But here you have several figures moving from left to right, but I've never seen anybody move from the right to the left in terms of movie stars. And I'd love to know if anyone can think of it. You can email me at sjross@usc.edu. Or just go on the history website at US University of Southern California, because I can't think of a prominent star on the right who moved to the left.
As we were talking, we've sort of skimmed over a couple of the famous people that you did chapters on in the book. One was Harry Belafonte.
And of all the people I interviewed, absolutely the most charismatic person I've met. With Harry Belafonte, I discovered a story that was not in the history books, that is really only being known now both through what I've written on him, but more what he's written in his own autobiography where he's finally come out and talked about. Harry Belafonte was one of the Martin Luther King's two closest friends. Harry Belafonte was the single biggest donor to the civil rights movement. And Harry Belafonte essentially walked away. He had a career as both a movie star, a TV star, and most successfully as a singer. And again, what audiences may not know, in 1957, at the kind of peak of his career, singing-wise, he was selling more records than either Elvis or Frank Sinatra. And in 1959, disgusted with what he saw as the lack of politics in Hollywood on television and music, he walked away and went to work for King for the Civil Rights Movement for the next 9 years. And when I asked him how... And the more and more he told me about this, I said, I've read this stuff. How come? You know, people mention you were there and you were participating, but we have no idea what a central role you played. And he laughed and he said, well, that's because if you are a radical fighting the forces of capitalism, imperialism, and racism, you need to build as many alliances as you can. And you need to build a genuine big tent, not a rhetorical one, where everyone on the left is brought together. And you can't afford to have these factional fights on the left that has paralyzed the movement forever. And consequently, he became the only person who could move between the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SNCC, CORE, all the other Urban League, all the other groups, and particularly SNCC and the SCLC began to really fracture as SNCC got more militant in the latter part of the 60s. And Harry Belafonte was the only man they would listen to because they trusted him. And he worked, and he used to say, I didn't want to be in the spotlight. It would have been very easy for a celebrity like me to get a lot of national attention. But the movement would not have been taken seriously to have a singer movie star as its head. It needed to be focused on Dr. King. And that's why I purposefully stayed under the radar. And the only time I came out is when Dr. King, which is what he called him to this day, Dr. King would say, Harry, we need money. And then I would go do a bunch of concerts and take what I needed for my family and give the rest to Dr. King.
Now, wasn't he also affected personally by his commitments?
Yes, it really undermined what people also don't know, unless you've really paid attention, is his mentor was Paul Robeson, the most, as Adolf Manjou said, the most dangerous black man in America. And when Manjou was testifying, Adolf Manjou was probably the most conservative actor in Hollywood during the 30s and 40s. And when he testified before HUAC, the House Un-American Activities Committee, and they asked him, how would you define communism? He said, well, I can define communist. Anybody who goes to a Harry Belafonte concert and applauds is a communist. Or, excuse me, to a Paul Robeson concert and applause is a communist. Well, Robeson became the mentor for what I would call the Harlem Left. Which is in the late 40s, it was Belafonte, it was Ruby Dee, Ozzie Davis, and Sidney Poitier. And when Belafonte got called before, actually he was called before some of the Red Baiters for participating in this. He was supposed to go on the Ed Sullivan Show, and they weren't sure they'd let him on. And he went to talk to Robeson and said, what do I do? And Robeson said, Harry, remember, use your art as a weapon. I was making, you know, six figures until I got blacklisted, and now I'm making $2,500 a year. Basically, he told them to tell them what they wanted to hear. And so it wasn't that Belafonte lied, but he sort of feigned ignorance. I didn't know these groups I was singing at were left. You know, gee, I'm not going to do this again. So he got to sing on Ed Sullivan and continue his career. But it affected his marriage when he and his first wife divorced. She claimed it was about politics, that all he could think about and talk about was politics, that he ignored his family, he ignored his wife, he ignored everything on behalf of his politics. And when he got married to Julie, who is a white woman, he also suffered because for Harry Belafonte, he believed racial progress will happen when we don't talk about the color of who we love. And it got him in trouble with whites, it got him in trouble with blacks. And so he suffered a great deal for his politics.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with historian Stephen Ross about his book, Hollywood Left and Right, which is just out in paperback. Now, if we fast forward one more time, what would you say Warren Beatty's legacy is?
Well, Beatty is really interesting because Beatty did, most of the stars I wrote about did a particular kind of activism. Beatty was doing everything. He was active in the political trenches working for candidates. In particular, he was the media advisor and part of the inner circle both for George McGovern's campaign, but then became really a key advisor for the Gary Hart campaign, really talking to him about, in a sense, the Democratic equivalent of George Murphy. How do you use the media? to present your ideas in the most effective way. And we're no longer in a day and age where you can talk for an hour and people get to listen. You have to talk in sound bites. So he was trying to train both McGovern and Hart. How do you talk in sound bites? How do you get these crisp, to-the-point sentences? And at one point, I was interviewing Gary Hart, and he told me, I can still remember being in Warren's kitchen, and you know, I was going through one of my speeches with him, and he kept interrupting me, you're taking too long, you're taking too long, you're taking too long, get to the point, get to the point, get to the point. So Beatty was really instrumental there, except, you know, as people pointed out to me after reading that chapter, they said, yeah, but these guys all lost.
Both of them, yeah.
Well, it wasn't about necessarily winning, because that gets into a whole nother issue about what I call the 50.1% dilemma that's run through American politics, particularly left politics, which is your goal to get elected, to do what you need to do to get elected, to get that 50.1%, and then when you're in office, in other words, you may have to compromise, but you compromise, you get into office, and then you fight for what you believe in. Or the other side says, but if you compromise so much to get that 50.1, you have nothing left to really bring to the office. And Beatty was a believer that, you know, you have to say what you wanted to say. And ideally, you want to get into office, but you got to raise the consciousness of the people. So I don't think he saw himself as a loser, even though those people lost the elections. The other thing Beatty did is he said, well, and in the end, because he was asked to run for Senate, and if people may remember, people were trying to approach him to run as the Reform Party candidate in 2000 in the presidential election. And the Reform Party was the party that got Jesse Ventura elected governor in Minnesota. And he felt ultimately that, no, I can do more politically in film, because in film, I control everything. And if you look at his films, from Bonnie and Clyde to Shampoo to Reds and to a film that I particularly like, Bullworth.
I loved Bullworth.
These are very political movies, particularly Reds and Bullworth. As a Shampoo, these are very stinging political commentaries, and Beatty gets it because you're trying to merge entertainment with politics. You're not trying to make movies that are on the nose. You're trying to make movies that can entertain audiences, and in the course of entertaining them, you give them a strong political message. And so he's had that career as movie star activist, candidate activist, behind-the-scenes advisor. And, you know, now it's sort of his, you know, he's run his course.
You're a historian, so using the past as a basis to look into the future, do you see up-and-coming actors who might be taking on the role of the next?
Yes. The only one I can tell you on the left who has a shot at this moment is George Clooney. Because if you look at, you know, who's on the left today that people would know? Sean Penn, George Clooney, and Alec Baldwin. Well, Sean Penn is too far to the left for most people. You know, once he goes and he's a big Hugo Chavez supporter and he's in the front row, along with Harry Belafonte at Chavez's funeral, that's enough. That's it. You know, you have no chance. Alec Baldwin, liberal Democrat, left liberal Democrat. But, all, you know, the minute they play that tape of him leaving the phone message, forget about his wife. People can understand you getting mad at your wife. You can't insult your child in the way he insulted her, calling her a fat pig. And that would, they would just play that he has no chance. But George Clooney has followed what I call the route that in many ways Charlton Heston pioneered, which is image politics, where you have a cinematic image that is so strong and so positive that people begin to believe that the image and the man are one and the same. So if you look across time, one could say on the right, someone like John Wayne had that, Jimmy Stewart had that, on the left, Gregory Peck had that, Charlton Heston had that, Moses. First he used it on the left, because it wasn't just being the first guy to participate in a civil rights demonstration. He led the Hollywood contingent on the March on Washington, and he used the Moses image very much to promote left causes. And then after 1972, when he broke with the Democrats, he used it on behalf of gun control and Republican candidates. And I believe that today George Clooney has the image as a positive straight shooter, somebody people would believe. You know, Eastwood had that as a conservative, but, you know, he harmed himself at the last convention. The talking to the chair just, I think people thought the guy's lost it now. Yeah. He's lost. And that's the problem of an actor who believes he can go off script. He's not as bright as he thinks he is. He's not a dumb guy by any means, but you can't go off script at a national convention like that and suddenly bomb and expect to have the influence anymore. But it would be Clooney on the left. And I don't think there's anybody right now on the right who I would say, it has that gravitas that could attract maybe somebody from the, what I would call the independent side or the uncommitted side.
And finally, given the enduring legacy of Ronald Reagan, which really has shaped American politics for decades.
Right.
Do you see a new shape developing as a result of Somebody Hollywood, or do you think it's going to be a continuation?
No. First of all, as people who look at this carefully would say, it's no longer Reagan, because Reagan would still be too liberal for many. Certainly for the Tea Party, he would be too liberal. I think we're seeing now a major shift, and I'm not sure which Republican is going to come out of Hollywood. But it's going to have to be somebody who compromises more. All you have to do is look what's going on in the Senate and in the House. And it's Republicans are realizing the demographics of this country have changed. Old conservative white men are no longer to be able to rule in the same blatant way. They will still rule this country, but they can't be as blatant anymore. And right now, the whole idea of immigration reform passing, of trying to create a compromise on gun control, these are all Republicans see that they have to move back towards the middle a little bit. They have to move from the extreme right to the far right. You know, they're not moving into a liberal position. It's not going to be liberal Republicans anymore, but it will be not Tea Party ruling. So if there's going to be a candidate who comes out, it's going to have to be somebody who can play to what became known as the Reagan Democrats, that is blue-collar Democrats who got so fed up with the seeming liberal politics of the party that they sort of moved into the Republican camp or they became independents. And right now, certainly amongst young voters, independents, I believe, are the fastest-growing sector. So you're going to have to get a Republican who can speak to that group, who can be a gentle. It's what Schwarzenegger tried to do. And for a while was actually successful until he couldn't rule. And that's something Warren Beatty pointed out when he was asked and pressured, won't you run against Schwarzenegger in 2000? And what Beatty said is, I know how to run for office. That's not the problem. I don't know how to govern in office. And those are two different things. And Arnold knew how to run for office. He didn't know how to govern in office. You can't insult legislators.
And then work with them.
I mean, it's one thing to do it in a campaign and in general, but when you get kind of calling them girly men and getting to that level and talking about how they're inefficient, how you're going to get rid of all of them, and then they're all there, how do you expect to work with them? And then again, attacking them in that way, once you're the governor, you can't do it. I mean, and that's what you saw. It is, he kept saying running a campaign is like running a movie opening. And he's right. You want to create a lot of pizzazz. But once the movie opens, the movie has to carry itself. And Schwarzenegger, the governor, the movie, was not strong enough. The previews look good, but the actual movie didn't work at all and fell flat. And he went from being, if we remember, there was time people were saying, let's have a constitutional amendment to allow immigrants to run for presidency. That wouldn't float now.
Well, Stephen J. Ross, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Again, the book is called Hollywood Left and Right. When we come back, with April as perhaps the most notorious month for victims of genocide, we'll analyze why genocides happen and how they might be prevented in the future. Stay tuned.
Цервох і мирним,
This is the Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. April has been a very dark month for victims of genocide. On April 24, 1915, Turkish authorities began their systematic annihilation of the Armenians in Turkey. On April 7, the Rwandan Hutu power government began exterminating the Tutsi population. In Cambodia, Pol Pot's Khmer Rouge regime launched its genocidal efforts on April 17. April was also the month that Serb leader Slobodan Milosevic began the Serb offensive to eliminate the Muslim communities in parts of Bosnia. Why does genocide happen, and how can it be prevented? With us are three experts. Ben Kiernan is professor of history and the director of the Genocide Studies Program at Yale University. He is the author of Blood and Soil, A World History of Genocide and Extermination from Sparta to Darfur, Cambodia, the Eastern Zone Massacres, and the Pol Pot Regime, Race, Power, and Genocide in Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge, 1975 to 1979. Alex Hinton is the executive director of the Center for the Study of Genocide, Conflict Resolution, and Human Rights. He is professor of anthropology and global affairs at Rutgers University and a visitor at the Institute for Advanced Studies at Princeton University. He is the author of Why Did They Kill? Cambodia in the Shadow of Genocide and editor of Genocide, Truth, Memory, and Representation and Annihilating Difference, the Anthropology of Genocide. Simon Baron-Cohen is a professor of developmental psychopathology at the University of Cambridge and a fellow at Trinity College. He is the author of The Science of Evil, On Empathy and the Origins of Cruelty and 0 Degrees of Empathy. He's also editor of Understanding Other Minds and The Maladaptive Mind. Thank you so much for being with us. I'd like to start with Ben Kiernan. You've identified 4 primary factors or themes when you've looked across genocides, although you say each are unique. What would you say those primary themes or factors are?
Well, in terms of the mindset of the perpetrators of genocide, the people who later go on to commit genocide or implement genocidal policies, some of the preoccupations and ideas that surface early in their careers and seem to be pointers to their later actions include, for instance, racial hatred or religious prejudice. Obviously, that's part of the definition of genocidal violence against an ethnic or religious or national or racial group. But other factors in the mindset of perpetrators that I found coming up again and again over a long survey of several millennia of genocidal occurrences, not only the racial and religious prejudice, but also an expansionist drive to take over territory. And along with that, a ideological obsession with how the land should be used, not just taking it over and ruling it or even expelling or killing the indigenous population, but also the fact that the correct usage of that land, and it's often agricultural cultivation, and so this leads to a prejudice against urban dwellers or hunter-gatherers, neither of whom are farming populations. And in many cases, not all, genocidal perpetrators have a fetish about cultivation. And along with that, a fourth factor is the kind of obsession with the ancient past of the ethnic group of the perpetrators, which what I call a cult of antiquity, an idea that there was a glorious past that the modern-day perpetrators of genocide, in whatever era they might be in, they're looking back at a glorious past that they want to recapture. And that often has a philosophical connection with their ethnicity, the origins of their ethnic group, which they want to reclaim the glory days of. And it also has something to do with the territory they allegedly once occupied and committing genocide against so-called intruders or people who get in the way of reclaiming that territory and that ancient ethnic purity.
Even the ethnic wars that didn't turn completely genocidal had a component of, say, the greater Serbia or the greater Croatia, greater Bosnia. But those may have not been completely accurate.
Oh, yes, they're often mythical. Sometimes there's a kernel of truth or more than a kernel of truth. Sometimes they're just invented. But quite often there is a kind of irredentist claim that goes along with the expansionism in the sense that this was once our territory. On the other hand, these 4 factors, when they're together, that's racism, expansionism, the obsession with antiquity and cultivation, they're powerful and explosive as a mix, but sometimes in isolation, just one or even 2 of the factors don't produce a genocidal outcome. And that's important to note, that even discrimination may not be more than an obsession. It might not even be practiced, and therefore it cannot always lead to genocide, but in combination with a militaristic expansionism, for instance, racial prejudice can be extremely virulent.
Alex Hinton, let's bring you in. How does this comport with your studies?
Right now, I'm writing on a book that focuses on Doik, who was the commandant of a prison camp in Cambodia, S21, which is now commonly known as Tuol Sleng. And I've sort of looked at three issues. One is, how does genocide come about? And Professor Kiernan has very nicely described a number of the key factors. The second thing is, how do people come to perpetrate acts of genocide and mass violence? And then I'm also looking now at notions of justice and the aftermath of conflict. From an anthropological perspective, I would look also at the way that difference is constructed. As Professor Kiernan was pointing out, that a genocidal regime will envision difference in a certain way so that people belong to the group, in-group, out-group. As it does so, usually the message, the ideological blueprint that they've devised, begins to resonate more with people in a context of socioeconomic upheaval. When a regime has come to power, typically they begin to manufacture differences that people might not otherwise be as aware of suddenly come into the foreground and are actually become linked to ideological messages and often structural messages, legal messages. So people begin to be differentiated in very specific sorts of ways.
Can you give some examples of those so people can understand?
So I'm going to talk about situations where genocide hasn't occurred, but the processes I'm talking about are all around us. With the events taking place in Boston, we have 9/11 is an example in the United States. Immediately in the aftermath of the bombing in Boston and then the seeking suspects, then two brothers have been located and they're being coded as Muslim and Chechen or from somewhere in that region. Most people probably have never heard of Chechnya, and suddenly that identity is foregrounded. It's something people become aware of, and it becomes fixed and differentiated. It's an us-them differentiation. That's 9/11 with the perception of Muslims and Arab Americans. The same sort of thing went on. And in genocide, it's taken to the extreme. So you have differences in awareness of other sorts of beings through an identity position are foregrounded. They become marked. By this, I mean dehumanized in certain sorts of ways, stigmatized in society. And as part of the blueprint of the ideological regime, and I should just note on the side as well, what I'm talking about is particularly applicable to what are called ideological genocide, colonial genocides, for example. The other thing is then people are rounded up and often confined. They're marked as other, and then the process can begin of eliminating those people. You know, another way sometimes I think about it through the acronym BPERP. B is in belief, the ideological beliefs and the personal views of the perpetrators. The PER is the perspective of people, the way in which the others defined by ideology and those messages are taken in by individual perpetrators. And the last P in BPERP is for position, and that's the person, the structural position the person occupies in the system and the position of the victim. And those three things interact over time, and the foregrounding of one of those three factors can be more prominent within a given context.
One other aspect that you had done in your work pertained to the psychosocial phenomena like honor, what you called face. How do these come into play? Honor particularly seems like it would be a contradiction to genocide, but you found them intertwined in some way.
Absolutely. One of the things that often emerges in explanations of mass violence, and especially genocide, is the notion that there's no meaning to it, it's meaningless. Today on a radio station, there was a student in Boston who said there's no logic to this. There is a logic. There are sets of cultural understandings that inform action. One of the things that a perpetrator regime will need to do as they envision difference, when they're envisioning difference, is they need to cast their ideology, in the case of the Khmer Rouge, for example, Marxist-Leninism was streamed in a way that people on the ground are going to understand. So if you're trying to appeal to peasants who don't have a great degree of formal education but may have been educated in the pagoda, as was the case, these terms are taken and molded and adapted so that they're going to resonate with local conceptions. Among the things that perpetrator regime may play upon are notions of status, which is linked to honor, face, people often think of genocide, mass murder, as if there are these maniacal ideologues who come about and manipulate a bunch of followers who blindly do whatever they say, but it's much more complicated than that. It's actually difficult to try and motivate people to do things that otherwise go against at least some of their beliefs, and this is a struggle that many perpetrator regimes have to deal with, and it changes through time, and sometimes it leads to the downfall of the group.
Simon Baron-Cohen, let's bring you in. You've been looking at the psychological basis of cruelty, of evil. You've identified a missing component among people who perpetrate these things, and that is empathy. How does it happen that people fail to either develop empathy or that develop the loss of empathy?
The points that Ben and Alex have made sit very comfortably within the framework of empathy. They've really been highlighting social factors that can lead an individual to lose their empathy in certain situations. Ben was talking about racism as one of his four factors. If the propaganda around racism is potent enough, you can lose your empathy for the other person, the person in the out-group. And Alex was talking about a very social, psychological perspective, in-group, out-group relations, that often when a racist propaganda is being created, the out-group will be described in very dehumanized language so that the in-group have reduced empathy for members of the out-group. And I think we saw that in genocides like Rwanda, where the propaganda was describing one ethnic group as subhuman, and you know, once you no longer see the person as a person, but see them as a subhuman or an object, then of course you become capable of treating them as an object. And I think that the missing component in the discussion so far is about the brain. I'm a neuroscientist, and what we've seen in recent research is a greater understanding of the brain basis of empathy. And what you can see when you image the brain whilst the individual is looking at somebody else and responding to someone else's emotions is that we all vary in how much empathy we have and in how much the empathy circuit in the brain is activated, for example, if we see somebody else in distress. So there are individual differences in empathy, and it may be some of those social, psychological factors, in-group, out-group relations, racism, you know, these kinds of things. For some individuals, it'll be enough to push them even lower down that empathy bell curve so that they become capable of hurting another person.
So what you're saying is that empathy can actually be turned off.
That's right. I mean, there are individual differences in empathy. There are different ways of measuring it, either using questionnaires or other kinds of psychological tests. And what you find is that some people have a lot of empathy, some people have just average amounts, and some people are starting off much lower, below average. But then there are situational factors that can make an individual have more or less empathy in a given situation. And, you know, when we try to make sense of why some people lose their empathy or fail to develop it in the first place, we have to look at both individual factors, for example, their genetics, their biology, but also these social factors.
I think two things arise from that. One is, on a mass level, how can empathy be erased? Is that what psychologists talk about when they talk about mob behavior or intergroup emotions that comes into play? And can empathy then be turned on for those people who may have previously had it shut off?
Both questions are really good. You know, the first one about crowd behavior. If you're in a group and you feel under threat, it's going to be hard to sustain your empathy for those who you believe are threatening you. So if the propaganda is telling you that the other group is about to attack, about to invade, they're about to even attack your family, you have a very primitive reaction biologically. Your cortisol hormone increases to get you ready for fight or flight. And in that condition, in that state, it's much harder to remember or to stay focused on the other person's feelings. All you want to do is defend yourself and defend those who you love. Whereas in other conditions, for example, peace or post-genocide, if there's a kind of reconciliation process, where you come face to face with the victim, your empathy could recover, where you begin to see the person, as a victim, with all of their subjectivity.
We certainly saw a little bit of that in South Africa during the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions. It wasn't a genocide per se, but some horrible human rights conditions. Alex Hinton, let me bring you back in for just a moment, because this sort of ties to what you called psychosocial dissonance. What is that, and how is it related to genocidal activity?
No, that's very relevant to the discussion. The notion of psychosocial dissonance speaks to Festinger's notion of cognitive dissonance, but places it into a socio-cultural context. So in other words, if people have different belief structures and they're brought into tension, it creates a dissonance. So one obvious thing that takes place in situations of mass violence and genocide is that most people are socialized not to kill or harm other human beings in one sense, but then they're put in a context where they're told that, for example, these aren't really human beings, they're evil enemies, microbes, viruses, so on and so forth. And that goes back to the marking of difference, but there's still a tension that someone still, in some sense, may or may not see a human being, and if they see them that way and they're told they're an enemy and need to be killed, it may create a dissonance, a tension within them that needs to be resolved. There are a number of different cognitive steps they can take. I think empathy is absolutely critical, as are other emotions like shame, and findings from neuroscience, psychopathology are directly relevant. I'm a little bit wary that there's a tendency for things to become overly biologized and for people to give primacy to something. And I'm not saying that Simon is doing this. I'm saying that it's something that exists with many people, where people want to look for the genetic roots of different things. And I think there's a danger that if that factor, which can be relevant in different ways, is taken and given primacy, it can then divert our attention from absolutely key social, cultural, and historical factors that are operative. And I sort of just put that caveat in. So it's not to disagree with Simon, but to say that for people who are listening, that we do have this cultural bias that exists in our society where we like to biologize things. And in terms of understanding genocide and mass violence, it's important not to have that come in and frame our understanding, or we'll lose sight of other important factors.
But rather just to understand that these are all contributors, and they're all things that we need to understand together as a construction of what we see in the world.
Absolutely. There are certain ways in which myths like Lord of the Flies, where you have this notion that people can have civilization, but they're brought, these kids go to this island, suddenly the veneer of civilization is removed and people are acting upon their baser evolved instincts. So we have these ways of thinking that float around, and again, there are ways in which factors linked to biology and evolution, emotion, neuropsychology are all relevant, but it jives with what people tend to think with their common folk understandings. I think that's an important caveat to put in there.
A quick reminder, this is the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the forces of genocide. There have been a number of genocides that have remained either unacknowledged or underacknowledged or flat out denied. Ben Kiernan, you've written about Native Americans. There's the Armenian genocide in Australia, a considerable denial of what happened with the Aborigines people. First of all, remind us of what did occur, and then give us a sense of what the cost is of unacknowledgement, underacknowledgement, or flat-out denial.
I would just like to quickly refer to what both Simon and Alex were just saying, if I could, because they both made a lot of sense to me. Alex talking about the broader historical factors, and Simon talking about empathy and the different gradations of empathy amongst different people. And I think that makes it hard for genocidal groups to recruit in normal situations. And what happens is that they tend to only thrive in the conditions of historical and social upheaval. War, massive destabilization, economic upheaval. In the Cambodian case, it was the massive intrusion of the Vietnam War into Cambodia and the widespread bombing that took place. And that enabled the Khmer Rouge to recruit supporters, but they also had to work on the existing empathy of many of those supporters by telling them who to attack and who was responsible for the bombing and so on. And they deliberately did that in telling the population they were recruiting, whose villages had been bombed and whose families had been uprooted, that they were being attacked not by the United States Air Force, but by the Phnom Penh population, the capital city, and the population there. And that turned a lot of the violence of the attacked peasantry against the cities. In terms of the number of genocides that have occurred in the 20th century, sometimes these are disguised or hidden behind wars. So it's often thought in some cases that such and such a genocide was not a genocide but a civil war. Often both are going on. They're not necessarily one or the other, but overlapping factors. One of the things that genocide studies in the field has uncovered over the last 50 years or so, particularly since the work of Raphael Lemkin, who really began this in the 1940s and was instrumental in having the Genocide Convention become international law, is that there were a large number of cases in history, and indeed since the Genocide Convention has become law, of genocide breaking out. Now, one of those that was for long not given the attention that it deserved was the genocide in Guatemala, for which a former president of Guatemala is now facing trial in that country. He's actually the first former head of state in the Americas to face trial for genocide. And the destruction of indigenous populations in Guatemala in the 1980s is still an event that hasn't got the attention that it deserves. I think it's true of many indigenous cases. Not all colonial or conquests of indigenous peoples led to genocide, but a number of them did, both in the Australian continent and in North America and Central and South America as well. And the genocide in Guatemala only 30 years ago is a kind of reflection of one of the worst cases of that.
In terms of people who dissent or try to stop genocidal activity, what can we learn from them? So I'll start with Alex.
I also wanted to return to your question about genocides that are out of focus, because I think it taps into a key thread that's emerging within the field of genocide studies. Some people have referred to it as critical genocide studies. And one part would be sort of informed by the Frankfurt School and critical theory, but another part focuses more on sort of destabilizing the tacit presuppositions of the field and the categories that lead us to look at things in certain sorts of ways. Just briefly, there has for a long time, in some sense, been a model of genocide that's informed by the Holocaust, with Auschwitz being the through metonymy standing for sort of epitomizing what genocide is. And I think that informed the UN Genocide Convention. And linked to this, people often talk about referring to some cases of mass violence as genocide, saying, well, if we call too many things genocide, it will dilute the meaning of the term. I call this the dilution metaphor, and it's sort of a gatekeeping metaphor and one that has ontological resonance in the sense that we all know what an impurity is, and it's something that we're familiar with. But there's no reason why we shouldn't necessarily, if cases fit a definition, referred to them as genocide. So it's this gatekeeping notion. I think a real shift in genocide studies has been that people are starting to look at a much larger range of cases. You know, at the center I direct, we recently had a conference, and there's a volume coming out called Hidden Genocides. Another scholar has a book called Forgotten Genocides. Ben has the volume that's been really critical in this move of sort of looking at the broad historical purview of genocide in a variety of different contexts, and probably has, you know, the foundational text. This has been a big shift to look at these sort of cases that are off the map that we haven't looked at because we have certain sorts of biases and preconceptions.
Knowing what we know psychologically, neurologically, sociologically, politically, Simon Baron-Cohen, what can we do to prevent genocide?
Just before I move to that question, the previous question was about hidden genocides or genocides that are off the radar. And I just wanted to mention that it's the 100th anniversary, as we know, of the Armenian genocide coming up. And it's just an opportunity for your listeners to, if they don't know about it, to go and read about it and learn about it. This is the Turkish Holocaust, it might be called, against the Armenians back in 1915, when Turkey constructed 25 concentration camps just outside of Turkey's border in Syria, with resulting huge numbers of Armenians being killed. So we just need to remember some of these other Holocausts that don't get the media attention that, for example, the Nazi Holocaust did and does. And to me, this reminds me that the risk of genocide is in every culture. It's not about a specific culture, and maybe that's the kind of link to prevention, that if we can identify, as Alex started out doing, some of the factors that together make a very potent risk, and start to educate people to watch out for these things in certain situations. That might be one step towards prevention, that when the media and when governments are using propaganda, history can show us that we can easily fall for it. But equally, once the analysis is laid out, you can then reflect, and that might be one step to guard against just succumbing to the impact of propaganda.
Ben Kiernan?
Along with the hidden genocides, there are also the hidden rescues, indeed the hidden rescuers and the hidden resistance. There's a very interesting op-ed in the New York Times today by Marcy Shaw, which talks about the anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, and she actually makes the point that although in some ways it was a hopeless cause, it did delay for several months the deportations from Warsaw to Auschwitz. We need to give more attention to the people who rescued victims or resisted and in fact inflicted casualties on the perpetrators and perhaps delayed or even offset or reduced the number of victims. That's one of the ways to look at prevention, is to study what it is that makes rescue possible and what kinds of people respond to requests to rescue or hide or otherwise shelter or help potential victims. One of the other aspects of genocide, at least as known in the public arena, is the lack of information about resistance. There were, in many cases, resistance movements that sprung up against genocide perpetrators and their regimes, whether it was in Bangladesh or East Timor or Cambodia or under the Nazi Holocaust or elsewhere. The people who try to prevent on the spot the deportation or murder of genocide victims really deserve more attention than they've got.
And Alex Hinton.
I agree with my colleague. I would just add that critical self-reflection is an absolutely key thing, because many of the dynamics that are taken to the extreme in genocide are around us all the time. Peer pressure is just an example, bullying, so on and so forth. Awareness of what's occurred in general through educational initiatives enhances the awareness of what potential exists in different societies and how genocide sometimes can come on fairly quickly and other cases it has a much longer duration. The notion that Simon foregrounded of empathy, I think, is absolutely critical. And from my anthropological frame, I would also sort of cast that in terms of this notion of understanding how we envision difference in different sorts of ways, how difference is crystallized, but to come to try and understand other people as opposed to readily going along with whatever ways difference is being catalyzed. And certainly in Boston right now, that's something that's being debated and it's at the forefront of discussions, even though, again, that's not a case of genocide, but that dynamic is one that you find taken to the extreme in genocide. Another key factor is international apathy, where people just don't care or it's not a quote-unquote strategic priority and people don't pay attention to it. I might conclude by noting that, in a sense, genocide prevention always fails, because if there's ever a successful genocide prevention, we'll never know.
You mentioned the international apathy. Do you think that the move towards tribunals and the International Criminal Court are having an impact on reducing either a full-out genocide or at least the kinds of mass human rights abuses that we have seen?
I think people's common folk perceptions, our ways of understanding, is that, yes, if you bring people to justice, it will fight impunity and act as a deterrence. And there's certainly some truth to that. But at the same time, I wouldn't want to just say, oh, we have this one thing and it will always work. That's one among a number of factors that need to be attended to. And in some ways, it's one that is often foregrounded. So it's great that we have these initiatives to have justice, been the case, you know, in some of the cases, like Guatemala or Cambodia right now, Argentina, the question immediately arises, why did it take so long to get to this point? So all the events that occurred during those years beforehand, they're historical events, political events, and they're questions that need to be asked about why it is that only now we're getting at this moment in time. It's not to say it's not good that we have it, but I think by only focusing on what's going on with the tribunals now, we erase other things that may be directly relevant, including, for example, geopolitics.
One of the things we didn't talk about was the legitimation of political violence in certain circumstances. And let me just do a final comment. Simon Baron-Cohen?
One point made earlier, I think by Alex, was that we shouldn't let biology take any primacy. And I would agree with that, that whether we're taking a sociological or anthropological or a biological approach, none of these have primacy. They're all just contributing factors in the mix.
And Ben Kiernan.
Absolutely. Multi-pronged prevention is the only way to go. I think it's the Human Security Report, sponsored by the UN, came up with the conclusion that the number of genocides has slightly decreased in the late 90s and in the 21st century, and that that may have something to do with the first international criminal tribunals for both Bosnia and Rwanda. But also, I think it's got something to do with the end of the Cold War, or more importantly, perhaps an awareness that conflict has to be avoided, that there needs to be attention given to not starting new wars, that there needs to be attention given to resolution of poverty and other historical and social problems that allow genocidal perpetrators to recruit supporters. I think that's absolutely key.
Thank you so much for being with us and sharing your work. Alex Hinton, Ben Kiernan, Simon Baron-Cohen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ben Kiernan is professor of history and the director of the Genocide Studies Program at Yale University. He is the author of Blood and Soil, A World History of Genocide and Extermination from Sparta to Darfur. Alex Hinton is the executive director of the Center for the Study of Genocide, Conflict Resolution, and Human Rights. He is professor of anthropology and global affairs at Rutgers University and a visitor at the Institute for Advanced Studies at Princeton University. He is the author of Why Did They Kill? Cambodia in the Shadow of Genocide. Simon Baron-Cohen is a professor of developmental psychopathology at the University of Cambridge and a fellow at Trinity College. He is the author of The Science of Evil on Empathy and the Origins of Cruelty and 0 Degrees of Empathy. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chipranankine Agassian and Leonardo Alanis, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes, and follow us on Twitter at armudian.